session of court. Judge Martin and I are pleased to welcome our colleague, Judge Bobby Baldock from the 10th Circuit, to sit with us today and Wednesday. He has helped us with our work on many occasions, and we very much appreciate his assistance. Sound system. It's going to be one of those days. Judge Baldock is a senior circuit judge, and the work of the judiciary would really grind to a halt if it weren't for the contributions of our senior circuit judges. They shoulder about 20% of the workload of the federal judiciary, and they work for free. They would get paid. They'd be paid their salary no matter how much they work. So we really, we have a great tradition with senior judge service to the federal judiciary, for which I think the bench and bar ought to be really grateful. So we're going to hear four cases this afternoon. You should know that we're familiar with your cases. We've read your briefs. We've read the authorities cited in your briefs. We've looked at least the portions of the record that you cited, and maybe even more of the record. And we're likely to have some questions for you this morning. In the limited time that is available to you, feel free to get straight to the heart of your argument and raise particularly the highlights of what you want to raise before we are likely to ask you questions. The questions, of course, are for our benefit, and this hearing's for our benefit. If a case has been set for oral argument, it's because we probably have some questions, because we hear a relatively small percentage of our appeals in oral argument. So I think our visiting judges will tell you, though, that when we have a case that's set for oral argument, it probably needed oral argument, and it means a good week of work for all of us up here. Please don't treat the red light as aspirational. When the red light shines, if you're answering a question from the court, of course, feel free to finish your answer, but do respect the red light and our time, and if we need more, we need to give you more time, we will do so. So our first case this morning is United States versus Couch. Mr. Vaughn.
May it please the court, Greg Vaughn for the appellate. The questions in this case are whether this criminal forfeiture proceeding is an alternate remedy and whether Mrs. Carver has standing to intervene to assert her relator's share. The court should find that the government has pursued an alternate remedy for three reasons. First, because of the plain language of the alternate remedy provision. Second, because of the overlap in the allegations of Mrs. Carver's complaints and the indictments. And third, because of the overlap of the funds at issue.
Well, let's talk about those reasons. It seems to me that if we look at the plain language and we look at the word, for example, remedy, that it has really no application to a criminal proceeding. That remedy is not the business of a criminal action. A criminal action is about punishment. The remedy is the word that you would expect to use in a civil or administrative setting. No?
Your Honor, through the forfeiture and the restitution process, the criminal court has an opportunity to seize ill-gotten funds from the defendants
right,
and return those funds to victims of the defendants' crimes.
That is true, but isn't there plenty of case law that says that a criminal forfeiture proceeding operates, quote, as a punishment against the party who committed the criminal acts? That's what our court has said. an opinion I wrote.
That's correct, Your Honor. We cite the decision of Bissig quite often in our brief. The Bissig decision that stood for the proposition that the criminal forfeiture statute and the alternate remedy provision can exist in this type of fact pattern. Both of them can operate because the forfeiture and the restitution, like Your Honor said, is to punish the defendants. But the alternate remedy provision of the False Claims Act is to ensure that the relator of the information does not get foreclosed from making a relator share. And Bissig says that you can do both of those under this type of fact pattern. It's right on point.
Well, but you know, the problem, the other problem with this case, it seems to me, is that the statute that regulates the criminal forfeiture proceeding we're dealing with actually provides for rights of intervention that do not include this intervention. Isn't that right? I mean, it spells.
I don't understand Your Honor's question.
Well, does it not allow for a person who holds a legal right, title, or interest in the property that was vested in the intervener or was superior to any right of the defendant at the time of the commission of the crime, or a bona fide purchaser for value who was at the time of the purchase reasonably without cause to believe the property was subject to forfeiture? That's what the statute provides, neither of which involves the situation we have here today.
Well, Your Honor, the alternate remedy provision provides an avenue for the relator to participate in that alternate proceeding and to apply the forfeiture statute, as Your Honor has quoted, to the detriment of the alternate remedy provision would render that other provision superfluous, would have no effect. In this case, Your Honor, the government has seized, through the forfeiture proceeding, substantial sums of money.
Well, counsel, I understand that. What bothers me, is it your argument or your understanding that this is the only remedy your client has? She could still proceed with her KTM action that she's already filed, can't she?
Yes, Your Honor, she is proceeding.
So this is not the only way that she can proceed.
The clerk has entered a default judgment against both of these doctors.
Is it a default judgment or just default?
A default. We have asked the court to enter a final default judgment with damages, but Your Honor, they couldn't even afford to hire lawyers to answer the complaint.
Well, my question is, it's a default that's been entered. Has there been a judgment in the default entered against? It has not, has it?
The default has been entered.
But not a judgment. Right.
In November of 2017 to ask the court to levy damages against the doctors, consistent with the amount of damages that the government obtained.
So you agree that this is not your client's only remedy. Now, going back to the question that Judge Pryor just asked you, because it seems that in looking at where it says no party can intervene in that, where it says that at the time of the commission of the acts that gave rise to the forfeiture of the property, that goes clear back to the criminal basis of this action, and your client did not have any rights, titles, or interest at that time.
She has a right in the United States interest in that property.
Not under this is where I'm going, so because of the language is pretty clear. You cannot intervene unless you had, and it lists two exceptions to that. And I don't see how you qualify under either one of those, and the False Claims Act doesn't get you there as far as I'm concerned.
Your Honor, we disagree. The False Claims Act says...
That's why you're here.
The plain language of the alternate remedy provision allows the government to pursue its claim through any alternate remedy.
And well, the government... you don't quarrel with the first part, it seems to me, of what Judge Baldock said, which is the two... which is what I was last asking you about, the two ways to intervene where the statute that regulates forfeiture proceedings does not benefit your client. You're instead trying to rely upon a different provision in the False Claims Act that speaks to alternate remedies, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the problem with that is a criminal forfeiture proceeding, it seems to me, is not an alternate remedy. It's not a remedy at law. It's about criminal forfeiture proceeding is about punishment. How do I get around that problem? That was the first problem I brought up to you.
Punishment that involves my names.
No, punishment that involves the proceeds of criminal activity, property involved in criminal activity. What case law can you point me to? What law can you point me to that would suggest that a criminal forfeiture proceeding could come within the scope of the meaning of a remedy in the False Claims Act?
The Bissek decision, Your Honor. The Bissek decision allows both the forfeiture statute and the alternate remedy provision to operate under this exact same fact pattern. Judge, the alternate remedy provision provides the structure for a QI-TAM relator to operate in the event the government pursues that claim.
In a civil proceeding. If they're pursuing an alternate remedy, if they're pursuing some kind of civil proceeding, maybe so. But that's not what's happening here.
Your Honor, the plain language of the statute says any available remedy.
Remedy.
Administrative. And when you compare.
This isn't administrative. You would agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor, I would.
Okay.
And when you compare the facts that we've alleged in the complaint and the overlap of the allegations in the criminal indictment, there's no question that there's significant overlap between those two documents. Further, the funds at issue, there is significant overlap as well. The complaint and all amendments to the complaint allege the submissions of false claims to defraud the government, Medicare and TRICARE. The second superseding indictment filed by the government specifies Medicare and TRICARE as health care benefits programs that have been defrauded.
Now, where are you going to prove up the basis of all the requirements under a QI-TAM action? You're wanting to prove it up in the criminal case, right? That this was not publicly noticed or was not known before she filed her action. All of those elements that you need to prove that your client's entitled to receive money, your argument is you are entitled to do all of that in this criminal proceedings, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, that's where we have problems with the difference between the remedy and the proceed, counsel. Excuse me.
The statute says that if the government pursues an alternate remedy, then the relator shall have the same rights in that alternate proceeding as they would have had in the QI-TAM proceeding.
Okay, now help me figure out with your argument. You have the False Claims Act where you're arguing any remedy, alternate remedy, and you have the criminal provision that says no intervention can be had except for these two exceptions, and those have to have arisen at the time of the fraud. So your argument is the False Claims Act takes precedence over the criminal act.
No, Your Honor. I'm arguing that the alternate remedy provision gives Mrs. Carver standing for a limited purpose to intervene in the forfeiture proceeding to assert her relator's share. The criminal court heard 7 weeks of trial in this case, heard a number of different witnesses. They are best situated to determine whether or not Mrs. Carver is in fact a qualified relator under the statute and then assess damages. It makes sense, and judicial economy too, to have the criminal court, but doesn't matter my opinion. The statute says if the government pursues an alternate remedy, then she shall adjudicate those claims in the alternate remedy court.
I follow, then you're putting all of your argument in the basket of this is an alternate remedy.
Absolutely.
All right.
And when you compare the indictments to the complaints that we filed, you will see that the allegations match up substantially. Substantial amount of overlap. And with respect to the dollars at issue, again, federal health care dollars. That's what was at issue in the criminal matter, and that's what's at issue in the QI-TAM matter as well.
Any further questions? Okay, Mr. Vaughn, you've saved 3 minutes for rebuttal. We're going to hear from Mr. Scarborough.
May it please the court, Charles Scarborough, Department of Justice for the United States. With me at council table is Deborah Griffin from the United States Attorney's Office in Mobile. She was one of the team that tried the criminal case. The district court properly denied Ms. Carver's motion to intervene in the criminal forfeiture proceeding. As this court has been discussing with opposing counsel, there are statutes that regulate when someone may intervene in a criminal forfeiture proceeding. 21 U.S.C. 853K expressly forbids parties from intervening absent certain circumstances enumerated in 853N. And they concede, I think, that they don't meet those circumstances. Their argument, as you pointed out, Judge Baldock, at the end, is basically that there is a separate provision, the alternate remedy provision in the False Claims Act, that essentially trumps the more specific provision applicable to intervention in criminal proceedings.
Well,
and,
it
allows them to come in.
Counsel, I don't see it necessarily as a trump. What's bothering me, and I think the court right now, is when it talks about any alternate remedy. So what is the definition of a remedy in regards to what the court has to look at? Because you have the criminal statutes and you have the false, but neither the twain shall meet normally. But Congress in its divine wisdom says any alternate remedy. Pretty clear that gives her the right maybe to come in and try her KTEM action in a criminal proceeding. It sounds strange to me, but why isn't this an alternate remedy?
Well, no court has agreed with that. And I think part of my answer goes to what Judge Pryor was saying initially, is that a criminal proceeding is designed first and foremost to punish people. I mean, the reason for this criminal proceeding was to put these guys who were operating a pill mill into jail. And there
but the statute doesn't expressly exclude criminal proceedings, does it?
The statute doesn't expressly exclude them, but it doesn't include them either. And it refers at we're now talking about 3730C5, the alternate remedy provision. It says that the government may elect to pursue its claim through any alternate remedy available to the government, including any administrative proceeding to determine a civil money proceeding. I agree.
But including would indicate
that's inclusive language. Right. I'm not. But my point is simply that it's evidence, it's textual evidence that what Congress had in mind was an administrative sort of proceeding.
But it's talking about a remedial proceeding.
Yes.
Let's ask the question this way. Let's say the government gets the property. The property is forfeited to the government. Does that in any way act as a bar to the claim that the putative intervener would pursue in its false claims action, its QTAM action? Are they able to, is the defendant in that action able to say, oh, it's already, the obligation is already, the debt has already been satisfied?
No, Your Honor, and that's thank you for making that point. The alternate remedy cases, first of all, I want to make a threshold point that when you look at the alternate remedy cases, Bledsoe in the Sixth Circuit, Barajas in the Ninth Circuit, they all arise from the QTAM action. These alternate remedy determinations are made in the civil False Claims Act action. There are no cases where they make the determination in the criminal case.
But when the property's been forfeited by virtue of that, there has not been a remedy for that debt.
That's correct. And the point that I really want to
add, if the United States wanted to pursue a False Claims Act claim for this debt, it could do so.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the main point here, if I can get nothing else across, is that the government has not obstructed the QTAM action. The QTAM action is continuing forward. They have, as you said, Judge Goddard, they have defaults, but they don't have a judgment entered there because they still have to prove up their claims.
But you're saying that the alternative remedy that's available to her is the QTAM action, and the QTAM statute allows for an alternative remedy, which would indicate to me that there must be something other than a QTAM action to serve as an alternative remedy. Do you agree with that?
Well, just to be clear, I'm not saying that the QTAM action is an alternate remedy. What we're saying is that the criminal action is not. And really, I want to emphasize this point also.
I'm saying that her only remedy in this case is to go back to the QTAM action.
That's
no?
Right. I mean, the False Claims Act gives her a right to sue as a partial assignee on behalf of the government.
To my question. I mean, it's just circular. The QI-TAM statute says, if the government chooses an alternative remedy, then she has full rights in that action. And you're saying the only way she can proceed now is to go back to the QI-TAM action.
The reason for that, Your Honor, is that the criminal action isn't an alternate remedy. And I don't think that's a circular thing.
What would be another?
An alternate remedy, again, as contemplated by Congress, is something like an administrative remedy. There are statutes that allow, for instance, the Department of Health and Human Services to prosecute health care fraud and take an administrative proceeding. You know, if the government shut down the QI-TAM, and then said, I'm going to go through this administrative enforcement proceeding, that's precisely the sort of circumstance in which 3730C5 would allow you to say, I want some share of that. You can't cut me out of the relationship.
What options does Ms. Carver have now?
Her option now is to prosecute the QI-TAM, just like you any relator would normally have. There's no unfairness in that.
Nothing else, just the QI-TAM.
Yes, Your Honor. But again, like that's when you say just the QI-TAM, that's a powerful tool.
Well, I mean,
allow a private person to sue on behalf of the government. It's important to remember this is the government's claim. This is she only gets money if the government gets money,
right.
And she has to prove up her claim. This is the alternate remedy provision is first and foremost not a way of sort of short-circuiting the proof you need to make in the False Claims Act case and pointing to something else that you want a piece of over there.
So if she were to prevail in the false claim, in the QI-TAM action, and get full satisfaction of the judgment, a portion of that would go to the government.
Yes, a large portion of the government would go to the government. That's the way the statute allocates it. In a non-intervened case, she would get between 25% and 30% of the recovery.
But it's a practical matter. They forfeited everything, haven't they? Do they have assets they hadn't forfeited?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, again, I don't want to stray outside the record, but yes, and there's a pending appeal of the criminal case. The money currently sits in the DOJ Asset Forfeiture Fund, but it's also important to note that when the government, takes a criminal case and does forfeiture proceedings, there's restitution that gets paid to lots of people. And there's a federal statute that says the restitution goes first to the non-federal parties. So there may not actually be any money that goes to the government as a result of the criminal forfeiture action once all the restitution is paid out. But that works no unfairness to the relator.
But you're saying if she gets a judgment in the QI-TAM, then she can come into the forfeiture proceeding?
No.
After? Never. Okay.
The forfeiture proceeding. And again, the cases that talk about alternate remedies, Bledsoe, Barajas, La Corte in the Fourth Circuit, they all arise in the context of a civil False Claims Act action where the relator, says, I have a valid claim and the government is preventing me from, is basically seeking a substitute remedy somewhere else. And they're primarily administrative proceedings or like a global settlement of another QI-TAM. That's the sort of textbook scenario in which this arises. And the relator says, well, you're frustrating my right to recover. In my case, I think I should get a share of that thing. In no event, in any of these cases, does the relator get to barge into criminal proceedings. And I want to emphasize, we haven't talked about the Van Dyke case in the Ninth Circuit.
Yeah, that's really the closest case, isn't it? That's the closest on-point case we have, right?
And it's sad that it's taken me this long to actually mention our best case, but that is our best case for sure. And
we kept you busy.
It also emphasizes the limited nature of what we're asking here. The Van Dyke court, properly said it didn't have to decide for all time on a global basis whether a criminal forfeiture action could ever be an alternate remedy. It just had to affirm the denial of intervention in the criminal action. That's all we're asking this court to do here.
Because there's actually a specific statute that regulates that intervention, and that specific statute, even by the putative intervener's own concession, does not allow for intervention.
Correct, Your Honor. And there's not some leapfrogging over that statute from the alternate remedy.
I agree. I mean, I think that Ms. Carver's got problems with the forfeiture statute, but just entertain me. Give me the list of alternative remedies that the government could seek other than a QI-TAM that the relator could participate in?
Well, I think it's primarily administrative proceedings, like the HHS proceeding that I was talking about. There's, you know,
what about a civil proceeding? Well, what if the government sued the defendant for the false claim? So it wasn't being pursued qui tam on the relation of the government. The government sued. So in its own right. Would that be an alternative?
I think that could potentially be. But again, the cases talk about whether it is a substitute for the qui tam. And so a critical part of this, and I want to go to the statutory language here, and it's the second sentence of 3730C5. If any such alternate remedy is pursued in another proceeding, the person initiating the action shall have the same rights in such proceeding as such person would have had if the action had continued under this section. So that is a strong implication from the text of the statute that really the qui tam is in some way being shut down or impeded. And that's what the cases affirm, is that it's a substitute remedy. Ms. Carver can proceed.
Oh, if the government were pursuing the claim on its own, decided to pursue the same claim, then and were to obtain satisfaction of the debt through a judgment, that really would operate as a defense to the False Claims Act.
That's right, Your Honor. And in those circumstances, what would happen at the end, and I want to make very clear, this would happen in the civil False Claims Act case, not in the alternate proceeding, is the defendant would seek a credit for what the government had already got from him in whatever that alternate proceeding was, administrative or civil, whatever it was. And then the relator would be, if that credit was honored, the relator would be entitled to claim a share, a relator share, 25 to 30% of whatever that credit was. That's the way these work. But that's all something that happens at the tail end of a properly pled False Claims Act action that succeeds.
Well, now,
in the criminal action.
Let me stop you there. I'll give you a chance to catch your breath.
Sure. Sorry.
What bothers me is that the government has got in a criminal proceedings a total forfeiture proceedings, and it's all going to be forfeited, and it's going to become the government's property. Now, move over to the KTM action. Is the government going to come in and argue that you still have to prove all of these elements before you get any of this money? Whose side are you going to be on in that KTM Act when you could have joined in that initially?
So it's a declined KTM case, and one textual indication of how a criminal action...
Counsel, answer my questions. Where are you going to be in the KTM Act? You own the property. The government owns the property that's been forfeited now. What claim, if it's not an alternative, what claim then does she have? She's still got to prove up her total claim, of which you can oppose.
That's
saying
correct. That's correct, Your Honor.
The last part of that, then, any finding of fact or conclusion of law made in such other proceedings that has become final shall be conclusive on all the parties. So you're arguing that you're not bound by that. You can argue against her in the KTM action.
I'm not arguing that we're not bound by that. I think that, she can use findings in the criminal case to the extent there's overlap. The question, one of the hard questions here is how much is there overlap, whether she has a valid KTM. There's public disclosure issues. Those are False Claims Act issues. Whether the public disclosure bar, she can satisfy that. Whether she's an original source, those are all False Claims Act issues. Before you get to these difficult questions at the end of the day, what I'm telling the court is that it's the government's practice if at the end of the day she could recover and there's money that the government has recovered from something that it deems to be an alternate remedy, that the defendant would get a credit and she would get a piece of that. I should note that in this particular case, there's a lot of claims by non-federal parties who are victims. So there may well not be any money.
As
a result of the criminal forfeiture proceeding, right now the DOJ Asset Forfeiture Fund holds the money, but it's going to be paid out to lots of the injured parties, and the government may get nothing. So
let me. There's a lot of contingencies here. I want to follow up on your response, I guess it was partly Judge Pryor's response, that another alternative remedy that the government could seek is a civil action. But it, I mean, that would mean that the relator had approached the government, asked them to participate in the QTAM, the government has declined, and then goes out and files a separate civil action. Is that your... Is that what you think qualifies under this code section?
I'm saying, based on the cases, a lot of the alternate remedy cases involve a relator in one QTAM suit pointing to another QTAM suit that the government may or may not have intervened in and saying, our stuff overlaps with that. We came first, we prompted.
But that's
that.
Not an alternative remedy pursued by the government.
Well, if we were to intervene in the case...
Oh, if you intervened in one but not the other,
yes.
Okay. All right.
And so I think I was trying to respond to Judge Pryor's question about other things other than administrative proceedings. And so I think your point is well taken, Your Honor, that yes, there are civil actions. There are other False Claims Act actions, and that's...
But I'm still trying to get an alternative remedy that's not a QTAM action.
Again, the administrative process...
Okay. Is that the only other one?
I'm at a loss to sort of, you know, imagine all possible alternate remedies.
Well, how about two?
Well, I can
do
two.
No, you give me the administrative remedy, and then you've gone back to the QTAM action. I want something other than a QTAM action.
But again, that's the way the case has evolved.
Okay, so I'm thinking that there's one alternative remedy that you've given me, and that's the administrative remedy.
The question before this court is whether the...
No, but I get to ask you questions.
I guess I'm not able to come up with anything else right now is my answer.
All right.
My time is well over, but I want to come back to the main...
You've been answering questions from the court.
Sure.
You can take 30 seconds to wrap it up.
Well, the wrap-up point is that the alternate remedy provision doesn't sort of short-circuit the process under the criminal statutes, which, you know, decide, you know, how you get to come into a criminal proceeding. And the alternate remedy provision isn't a shortcut by which you can sort of abandon your QTAM mid-stride and say, I want what's going on over there. You have to have a valid claim. You have to prove overlap. And those are things that are decided in the Civil False Claims Act case, not in the criminal proceeding. And so all we're asking this court to do is follow the Ninth Circuit's well-reasoned opinion in Van Dyke and affirm the denial of the motion to intervene, which would mean under your court's jurisdictional rules that you would dismiss the appeal for lack of jurisdiction.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Vaughn, you have 3 minutes.
So at a minimum, they say we get to participate pursuant to Van Dyke. And that is that if the defendant doctors get a damage credit because of the damages that have been levied against them in the forfeiture proceeding, then Mrs. Carver can have a hearing before the QTAM court to establish that she is a relator, and if she is, the relator's share. I believe that's the government's position on that, and they've stated that in their brief. Your Honor brought up the interesting the point that they can't cite to any other form of alternate remedy besides administrative. There are three forms of remedy: civil, the QTAM action, administrative,
right,
and criminal.
Right. And the third of which is not a remedy.
Your Honor,
if you can point me to any action, any case law whatsoever that would suggest that a criminal forfeiture proceeding is a remedial proceeding, I would benefit from it.
Yes, Your Honor. The 86 amendments were passed by Congress as a safeguard provision for relators who have been down the journey like Mrs. Carver. She went to the government with these allegations. They encouraged her to file the complaint, and that's what she did. A year and 8 months later, then they filed their False Claims Act. Then they moved to extend the seal period for 3.5 years while the parallel criminal action proceeded to verdict. She was limited. She could not advance the QTAM case in any way, shape, or form to go after these assets, the same assets that the government was going after. So when they say no obstruction, no unfairness, Mrs. Carver wasn't able to litigate her case for 3.5 years.
I'm sorry, but does that have anything to do with a criminal forfeiture proceeding being remedial?
We believe it does, Your Honor, because you look at the legislative history, the House in its report, and the House version is the alternate remedy provision that we have. The House report identified criminal proceedings as alternate proceedings. And then you go back to the language of the alternate remedy provision, and it says any alternate remedy, no restrictions whatsoever. If they wanted to exclude criminal forfeiture proceedings, they would have said that. But they didn't say it. They put no limitations on the avenues the government could pursue to seek damages related to health care fraud, which in this case, Judge, is exactly what they did. They went after these doctors for overprescribing medication, for falsifying their lab results, and they sought damages against them for health care fraud. That was the alternate remedy that the government secured in this case. And we'd ask the court to follow the structure that the alternate remedy provision provides for relators like Mrs. Carver and future relators.
Thank you, Mr. Vaughn.
Thank you.
We have your argument. Our next case is Rogers versus AWB Industries.